Imagine for a second dropping over $1,000 on a brand new gaming device.
Which is a massive investment.
Exactly. And the creator of this machine looks you right in the eye and absolutely refuses to call it a console.
Oh, yeah, they hate that word.
They really do. But then, just as you get it plugged in, you read the news that the online game you've been playing every single day for the last 10 years is getting permanently shut down.
I mean, it sounds like this brutal, hypothetical, worst-case scenario, but as of this week, it's the actual reality of the market.
It really is. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we have this massive stack of sources from Tekken Knight's Tuesday Tech and Gaming newsletter.
Great newsletter, by the way.
Oh, it's the best. And our mission today is to explore this massive, often contradictory tension between, well, cold corporate bottom lines and the passionate communities that actually keep the gaming industry alive.
It is a fascinating dynamic to unpack,
Yeah.
you know, because we're looking at an industry producing some of the most incredible technological leaps ever, while simultaneously facing down some incredibly harsh financial realities.
Yeah. And whether you're a hardcore PC builder who loves analyzing every new microchip or just a casual player wanting to relax on the couch, you need to understand these shifts.
Absolutely,
Yeah.
because it affects everyone.
Right. Or honestly, even if you're just fascinated by multi-billion dollar tech strategies, we are looking at how global supply chains, bleeding edge AI, and corporate IP laws are directly dictating what you play, how much it costs, and whether you actually own any of it at the end of the day.
Yeah, the decisions being made in boardrooms right now, they're going to reshape the digital worlds we inhabit for the next decade. No question.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with what has to be like the most controversial hardware announcement of the year.
Oh, you mean Valve's new Steam machine?
Yes. They finally dropped the pricing, and it is a total shocker. The base 512 gigabyte model is $1,049.
Which is steep.
Very. And if you want the 2 terabyte version, you are looking at $1,428.
Yeah, and remember, Valve was incredibly adamant during the press conference. This is not a console.
Right. They were so specific about that.
Very specific. They want everyone to understand that this is a high-end gaming PC. It just happens to be designed to sit beneath your living room TV.
But those prices, I mean, $1,000 as the absolute floor, what is actually driving that cost? The newsletter pointed to something called Ramagedon.
Yeah, Ramagedon is the big culprit here. It's the industry term for the global memory chip shortage that hit really hard in late 2025.
Oh, right, because of the AI boom.
Exactly. Surging demand for AI completely disrupted the supply chains in East Asia. Basically, these massive AI data centers were vacuuming up all the available memory production.
Just buying everything in sight.
Pretty much. And because of that sudden scarcity, the prices for DDR5 and LPDDR5X memory spiked by like 200 to 300% in just a matter of months.
Wow. And just to clarify for everyone listening, LPDDR5X is low power, high bandwidth memory, right? Like the really good stuff.
It is. It's incredibly fast and efficient, which is exactly what a compact machine needs. PCMag did a full teardown, and they found 32 gigabytes of that exact RAM inside.
That's a lot of memory for a living room box.
It's massive. And it's paired with a custom AMD APU.
And an APU is basically when they jam the main processor and the graphics card together onto one single chip to save
I
space.
hit the nail on the head. It's comparable to a high-end Ryzen 7 chip. But Valve apparently spent over $50 million co-developing this specific architecture with AMD.
Wait, 50 million just on research and development for one chip?
Yeah, just to get the thermal and power characteristics perfect for a living room environment. They even built this proprietary vapor chamber and wrote a custom fan curve algorithm to keep the whole thing whisper quiet.
Okay, so the sheer hardware cost is legitimately massive. But here's the thing. Buying a Steam machine feels a bit like buying a luxury sports car, but then finding out you still have to act as your own mechanic to tune the engine.
That's a really good way to put it, actually.
Right. Digital Foundry explicitly said it's for hardcore gamers, not families. Like you are dealing with PC driver updates, tweaking graphics settings, troubleshooting compatibility.
All the standard PC headaches.
Exactly, just on your couch. So I have to push back on the pricing here. With the PlayStation 5 Pro sitting at $699 and the Xbox Series X at $499, will mainstream consumers really pay a massive premium for this?
Well, for the mainstream consumer, probably not. But the underlying financial strategy here is what's truly brilliant. Valve isn't playing the same game as Sony or Microsoft.
What do you mean?
Traditional console makers usually sell their hardware at a loss. They bleed money up front to get you into their ecosystem and then slowly make it back on game sales and subscriptions.
Right, the classic razor and blades model. Give away the handle, sell the blades.
Precisely. But Valve already takes a 20 to 30% cut of every single game sold on Steam. They don't need this machine to be a mainstream hit.
Oh, because they're already making so much on software.
Exactly. Forbes interviewed Michael Pachter, an industry analyst, and he pointed out Valve only needs to sell 2 to 3 million units for this to be a massive success.
Just 2 or 3 million? That's tiny compared to PS5 sales.
It is, but at over $1,000 a pop, with an estimated $200 to $250 profit margin built into the hardware itself, Valve stands to make up to $750 million in pure hardware profit.
That is insane.
And, crucially, they lock those hardcore, high-spending PC gamers even deeper into the Steam ecosystem. Mm. It's a calculated, low-risk, high-reward play.
Okay, so while Valve is using expensive proprietary hardware to lock gamers in, a major component manufacturer is taking the exact opposite approach. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, you're talking about AMD?
Yes. AMD is using software to essentially upgrade the hardware you already own for free.
Yeah, this was a genuine surprise to the industry. We're talking about the early release of FSR 4.1.
Fidelity FX Super Resolution, right. They're upscaling tech.
Exactly. It was actually supposed to drop in July, but AMD pushed it out early for their previous generation cards, the RDNA 3 series, and even some older RDNA 2 cards.
Which are basically the foundational architectures for their older stuff. But the tech here is wild. The sources say it uses a hybrid spatial and temporal neural network. Can you, like, break that down for us? What does that actually mean for the player?
Sure. Think of it like a team of extremely fast artists making a high-definition flipbook. The spatial network is the artist analyzing the single page in front of them, looking at the edges, the textures, to make the image sharper.
Okay, so making the single picture look better.
Right, but a video game is in motion. Mm-hmm. So the temporal network is the artist looking at how the paint moves between the pages to smooth out the action. By utilizing dedicated AI accelerators, it can guess what the next frame should look like without the graphics card actually having to render it from scratch.
And Tom's Hardware found that running this AI process only increases power draw by like 3 to 7 watts. How is it doing all that heavy lifting without melting the graphics card?
Because they utilized INT8 precision for the calculations.
INT8?
Yeah, 8-bit integer math. It's essentially a lower precision form of mathematics that requires massively less computing power and generates far less heat.
Oh, so they sacrifice a little accuracy for efficiency.
A truly microscopic amount of mathematical accuracy, yeah.
Yeah.
But they gain a monumental boost in performance. Players are seeing 35 to 45% better frame rates.
That's a huge jump.
It is. And a 60% reduction in ghosting, you know, that weird blurry trail you sometimes see behind moving objects. It's basically black magic for older GPUs.
But wait, if AMD uses AI to magically make my 3-year-old graphics card run Cyberpunk 2077 at 60 frames per second on ultra settings, haven't they just destroyed my incentive to buy their next generation of graphics cards?
That is the $500 million question right there.
Right. Like, why give this away?
To answer it, we really have to look at their main rival, NVIDIA. NVIDIA's strategy with their equivalent tech, DLSS4, is to strictly lock it behind their newest, most expensive RTX 40 and 50 series cards.
So building a walled garden?
Completely. If you want the new software, you have to buy the new hardware.
Which forces the consumer to upgrade.
Exactly. But AMD is playing defense here. Currently, they hold about 25% of the discrete GPU market share. And that 25% is worth roughly $500 million in quarterly revenue.
Okay, so they have a lot to lose.
A ton. Mm-hmm. And with NVIDIA getting so much praise and Intel's upscaling tech improving, AMD was terrified of gamers jumping ship. By democratizing FSR 4.1, they preserve a huge amount of customer goodwill.
Oh, so it's about loyalty.
Exactly. They are ensuring that when you do eventually decide to upgrade, you stay loyal to the brand that didn't force your hand.
So they protect that $500 million in revenue, even at the cost of short-term hardware sales.
It's a long-term play for brand survival.
But, you know, as incredible as this tech is, even the best upscaling hardware in the world cannot save a game when the corporate math simply stops making sense.
Yeah, this is the tough part of the newsletter.
It is. It brings us to the harsh, emotional reality of live service games. Destiny 2 is officially dying.
It really is a seismic shift for the industry. Sony and Bungie announced that after the current season of The Wish, Destiny 2 will cease receiving new content.
The servers stay on for now, right?
Yeah, you can still log in, but active development is completely dead.
And this news dropped right alongside 200 staff layoffs at Bungie. What really struck me was the reaction from the community, specifically their direct rivals.
Yeah, the Warframe statement was amazing.
Megan Everett, the community director for Warframe, which is arguably Destiny's biggest competitor, she said, "No one is celebrating. A world without Destiny isn't a positive one."
Those two games pushed each other to be better for a decade. Warframe's movement inspired Destiny. Destiny's raids inspired Warframe. It highlights the very real human element of these digital spaces.
Millions of people formed friendships in those servers.
They did. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the financial reality behind the shutdown is brutally stark.
Well, walk us through those numbers because they are staggering to look at.
Okay, so in 2020, at its peak, Destiny 2 was generating around $800 million in revenue. But by 2025, that number had plummeted by 65%.
Down to what?
Dropping to between $200 and $250 million annually.
Which, I mean, to the average person, sounds like a mountain of money, $250 million a year. How does a game making that much get shut down?
The revenue looks huge until you examine the operational costs. Former developers spoke anonymously to Forbes and revealed it was costing up to $200 million annually just to maintain the live service.
Where does $200 million a year go on a game that's already been built?
Well, running a live service isn't just paying for server electricity. You're funding hundreds of developers who have to constantly churn out new seasonal content every 3 months.
Oh, right, the content treadmill.
Exactly. Plus, massive QA teams testing that new content across millions of different PC and console setups. And live operations teams monitoring server health 24/7.
That adds up fast.
It does. When your revenue drops to $250 million and your maintenance cost is $200 million, your profit margins have basically evaporated. After the Lightfall expansion failed to retain players, the audience just didn't come back.
It's like a beloved decade-long TV show suddenly getting canceled on a massive cliffhanger.
That's a perfect analogy.
Right. And it's not because the writers ran out of ideas. One developer actually said they had years of story planned out. But because the network executives want to divert the entire budget into a risky new cinematic universe.
That is exactly what is happening. Sony is forcing a massive strategic pivot. They are shifting all of Bungie's remaining resources to a new project codenamed Matter, scheduled for a 2027 reveal.
And that's an extraction shooter, right?
Yeah, a brand new extraction shooter with RPG elements.
Yeah.
And Sony is banking on Matter having a $3 to $5 billion projected lifetime revenue potential.
So they looked at the spreadsheet and traded a barely profitable legacy game for a multi-billion dollar lottery ticket.
Completely.
But I have to ask about the psychological toll on the consumer here. Millions of players poured a decade of their lives, their money, their evenings into Destiny 2. Does this set a terrifying precedent?
In what way?
Like, are gamers going to be afraid to invest their time in any live service game moving forward, knowing the plug can just be pulled the minute a corporate spreadsheet says the margin is too thin?
Industry analysts and the sources note that is a genuine risk. Consumer trust in live service models is incredibly fragile right now.
I can imagine.
Yeah, when players realize their investment is totally ephemeral, they start migrating to games that offer immediate tangible value. Or they retreat back to single-player experiences where server shutdowns aren't a threat.
That makes total sense. And that profound grief over Destiny 2 proves that fans deeply, deeply care about these digital worlds.
They really do.
But what happens when fans care so much that they actually take it upon themselves to build and preserve the games themselves, while they run straight into a wall of corporate legal teams?
Which brings us to the infamous Nintendo Ninjas.
Right. YouTuber Kryzenex just voluntarily canceled his Ocarina of Time fan remake. And this wasn't some weekend coding project. He has been building this from scratch in Unreal Engine for a decade.
Since 2015. It was gorgeous, too. Ray-traced lighting, 4K textures, a fully reorchestrated soundtrack.
And he shut the entire thing down preemptively to avoid getting crushed by Nintendo's lawyers.
And honestly, looking at the history, he had very good reason to be terrified. Nintendo has a legendary track record of aggressive legal action against their own fans.
Yeah, they took down the AM2R Metroid remake. They nuked Pokemon Uranium.
And in 2023, they famously sued a 15-year-old streamer just for broadcasting Tears of the Kingdom before its official release date.
A 15-year-old? Wow. So Cryzenex saw the news that Nintendo had announced an official Ocarina of Time remake for the Switch 2, launching in November 2026, and he knew he was in the crosshairs.
He literally commented on his page, "I don't want to end up disappeared like the others."
That is so bleak. But contrast that Iron Fist approach with what we're seeing from other major publishers. Take Rockstar Games, for example. Fans just discovered a Tommy Vercetti Easter egg in the GTA 6 trailer a full year after it dropped.
Oh, the specifics of that discovery are mind-blowing.
Tell me about it.
So fans found an iguana wearing Tommy Vercetti's exact blue floral Hawaiian shirt exactly 33 seconds into the second trailer. And it took a year to find because the iguana is only on screen for 0.3 seconds.
In a crowded background.
Exactly. A fan had to download the video, watch it in 4K resolution, and scrub through it at quarter speed just to catch it. And Rockstar loves this level of obsession.
They feed on it. And look at Capcom. They are hosting a spotlight event tomorrow specifically to give fans exactly what they've been begging for.
Right. A Dragon's Dogma 2 expansion and an Onimusha remake built on the RE engine.
So what does this all mean? Why do Western companies seem to embrace this obsession while Nintendo actively crushes it?
This raises a really important question about the deep cultural divide in intellectual property management. IGN's legal expert weighed in on this in the newsletter, and the context is vital.
What's their take?
Well, Western studios like Valve, with their massive modding community, or CD Projekt Red, or Rockstar, often view fan obsession, user-generated mods, and intense Easter egg hunts as free marketing.
Right. It builds an organic, fiercely loyal community that keeps the game alive in the years between official releases.
Exactly. It's community building through shared passion. But Nintendo's approach stems from a very strict Japanese corporate philosophy.
Which is much more rigid.
Very. In that framework, brand integrity and quality control are absolutely paramount. They do not view fan projects as flattering homages. They view them as a dangerous dilution of a carefully controlled brand image.
They want total control.
Absolute authority over how Zelda looks, how Mario sounds, and how their games play. From their perspective, it isn't malicious, it is strictly protective.
But I have to challenge that philosophy. Is it actually protecting the brand, or is it just alienating the very fans who enthusiastically buy their products?
That's the debate.
Because the source notes that the moment Cryzenex announced he was canceling his project, illegal downloads of his final playable build absolutely skyrocketed across the internet.
It's the ultimate Streisand effect.
Exactly. As one Reddit user pointed out, when Nintendo bans something, everyone suddenly wants to have it.
That is the paradox of aggressive IP enforcement. By trying to erase the fan project from the internet to protect their upcoming Switch 2 remake, they accidentally immortalized it.
And it created a ton of friction between the company and its most dedicated evangelists.
Yeah, it's a messy situation.
It really is a deep dive full of contradictions today. Think about what we've covered. We've got Valve taking a massive financial gamble on premium, highly complex hardware while stubbornly insisting it isn't a console.
Right.
We've got AMD democratizing their high-end AI upscaling tech, giving it away to defend their market share against NVIDIA's walled garden.
Software to save the hardware.
Exactly. We witnessed the bittersweet, financially driven death of Destiny 2, marking a very real turning point for how we view live service games. And we saw Nintendo cracking down on a decade of fan passion just to clear the runway for their official commercial remake.
And the single common thread connecting all these disparate sources is that modern gaming is no longer just about silicon chips, lines of code, and frame rates.
Not at all.
It is an incredibly intense emotional battleground. It is the constant push and pull between genuine community passion on one side and cold, calculated corporate strategy on the other.
And for you listening, it is crucial to remember that every dollar you spend, every piece of hardware you buy, and every single hour you invest in a live service directly influences these massive industry shifts.
You vote with your wallet.
Exactly. Valve priced that Steam machine at over $1,000 because their data tells them a segment of you will gladly pay for it. Sony shut down Destiny 2 because the engagement numbers on the spreadsheet told them to pull the plug. The market adapts entirely to what you are willing to tolerate and support.
Knowledge really is your best defense in this landscape. Understanding the business mechanics behind these announcements, the supply chain realities driving up costs, the profit margins dictating game lifespans, the IP laws threatening fan projects, it all allows you to make truly informed decisions about where you invest your limited time and your hard-earned money.
Which leaves us with one final lingering thought to chew on today. We started this deep dive by imagining dropping $1,000 on a device right as your favorite decade-old game gets deleted from existence.
Right.
With live service ecosystems shutting down at a moment's notice and passionate fan preservation projects being threatened with corporate lawsuits, do we ever actually own the digital worlds we inhabit?
That's a haunting question.
Or are we all just temporarily renting our memories from massive corporations totally at their mercy until they decide the lease is up?
That is the fragile reality we are all navigating right now.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the forces shaping the screens in our living rooms. Keep questioning what you play, and we'll see you next time.